So, the one thing that I would like y'all to be sure that you know about this text is I want to give you a little more context. You know if you've been looking at the Existentialist Cafe, or if you've read anything about Sartre and de Beauvoir and Camus, their interaction with the French Resistance during the war. Jaspers was German. He was at the University of Heidelberg. He'd started off as a psychiatrist. Well, actually, he started off going to school to be a lawyer, but then he ended up going into medicine and psychiatry. And when his second book was published, The Psychology of Worldviews, he was offered a chair in the Department of Philosophy and Psychology at Heidelberg. Those departments were almost always the same department up until about 100 years ago. So Jaspers, kind of comes at things from the point of view of the psychological, right? And he even develops what he calls Existenzbiographie. And Existenzbiographie is where he goes in and he looks at the life of the thinker, and he looks at the letters the thinker may have left behind, and the different testimonies that might have been written about the thinker. And he looks at the thinker's production, his works of art, or his plays, or his literature, or her philosophical writings. And then he sort of develops what you might call a psychopathological profile, or a psychological profile of the thinker, right? And he calls this Existenzbiographie. So a little bit what you're getting here with the Kierkegaard and the Nietzsche are these little, when he's talking about them in this text, it sometimes sounds a little bit like a psychiatrist is talking about a couple of philosophers, right? And that's right. So every now and then you're getting these little blips of Existenzbiographie when he's talking about Kierkegaard and Nietzsche. The background for these lectures, I think, is extremely important. Most existential philosophy began and occurred and really got underway after World War I, through the Roaring Twenties, into World War II, and post-World War II era after the dropping of the atomic bomb. That's the height of existential philosophizing, the existential literature. In 1936, Carl Jaspers was still had a chair at Heidelberg. Who was in charge of Germany in 1936? The Nazis. Martin Heidegger had famously joined the Nazi Party in 1933, so he could basically become rector of the University of Freiburg. That's a political appointment, basically, right? Because all universities in Germany are actually controlled by Germany, whether they're a Protestant or a Catholic university. So he joined the party so that he could become rector, and this was kind of the final break between Jaspers and Heidegger. Jaspers still was teaching in 1936. The Nazis had not completely scoured the universities yet, but they were beginning to do that. Carl Jaspers came from a family that had included a brother that was a national hero in World War I. He fought with the Red Baron. He fought with the Red Baron, flew planes, right? With von Ribbentrop, the Red Baron, and one of his other people that he flew with was a man named Hermann Göring. Yes?
Richthofen,
I'm sorry, thank you. Baron von Richthofen. So Baron von Richthofen, the Red Baron, and Hermann Göring were great close friends, who was one of the big Nazi epidemics, were both great friends of Jaspers' brother. After the war, Jaspers' brother suffered from post-traumatic stress syndrome. He ended up taking his life in the 20s. But It's my contention that because of his relationship to a man who was hailed because he got the Iron Cross and he was a national hero, because of his relationship to a man who was not only a national hero, but had been a friend of Hermann Göring, Jaspers was not treated exactly the way somebody who was a radical intellectual, anti-Nazi, married to a Jewish woman would have been treated. 1936, he still had a professorial chair at Heidelberg. The Nazis arranged for him to give a lecture in the Netherlands. They bought him a ticket to go to the Netherlands and give this lecture. They wanted him to get the hell out of the country, and they were basically sending him a message. Go give this lecture. Here's your excuse to get the hell out of Germany. Don't come back. It was a one-way ticket. So that was another clue. So Jaspers showed up, showed his papers to the Gestapo agents that he was fixing to leave the country, and then he made sure to point out, please look and see that I now have a round-trip ticket and I will be coming back. So in reality, when Jaspers was doing these lectures, he was doing them in a sense, at the behest of the Nazi government to get him out from underneath their feet because they didn't want somebody like Jaspers in Germany. But the reason I brought up the stuff about his brother and Göring and all the rest of it is that Jaspers returns from these lectures. After he returns from these lectures, he gives his last lecture course, which is on Nietzsche. And it's a Nietzsche that is lecture course that is specifically given to demonstrate that Nietzsche has absolutely nothing in common with the Nazis, and that it's a travesty that Nietzsche would even be utilized by the Nazis or Mussolini. Mussolini actually funded the Nietzsche archives. That he would be picked up and utilized by them as a justification for their anti-Semitism and their Aryanism and all the rest of the crap that they tried to justify with Nietzsche. Nietzsche's sister, of course, we know, was a crazy woman who was an Aryan, who was an anti-Semite, and she specifically kept funneling all of his documents in such a way as to make him look more like an anti-Semite than an Aryan. Well, anyway, the Jaspers came back from this, gave his last lectures on Nietzsche, and then they withdrew his professorship. From 1937 to 1944, he basically lived under a self-imposed house arrest in Heidelberg, and would not leave. Regularly opened his windows and played the BBC as loud as he could out of the window. Often shamed Nazi officers for bullying people outside of his house. One time went down his steps and where an SA officer was terrorizing some young man and woman. I think it was a young man and woman, and he recognized the SA officer as someone who'd been one of his brightest students 6 years before. And he walked up to him and he said, "What are you doing?" Hare, whatever his name was. And of course the guy, you know, he's like, "Ah, Professor Dr. Jaspers." And he said, "I can't believe that someone I taught would be doing what you're doing right now." So he was always pushing the Nazis. And the only thing I can figure out as to why he wasn't, you know, put in a camp and his wife killed is that, you know, Göring was like, let him do what he wants to do. He's just a stupid philosopher anyway, but he was also my brother's friend. His brother was also my friend. I can't think of any other reason besides that. But at any rate, Jaspers became a voice for anti-Nazism and anti-fascism in Germany to such a degree that after the war, when he was asked to come back to Heidelberg was under the control of the Americans, right? So Germany was split up into four regions: the Russian region, the French region, British region, and the American region. The American general in charge of Heidelberg asked him to reopen Heidelberg University. And Jaspers came back to him 2 weeks later or a month later, and he said, these are the names of the people who can teach again. Everybody else was connected to the Nazis somehow. Five people. And of course, you can just hear the American general. Supposedly, when Jaspers wasn't there, he said, I can't run a fucking university with five professors. And so he asked Jaspers to step down from rearranging the opening up of Heidelberg, and we started the process of which we should all be well aware of, that America very quickly began to make friends with Nazi sympathizers after the war because at least they were anti-communists. Right? Okay, so I think all of this kind of should play into what you're reading here, because the point about this course that I want y'all to get is that for Jaspers, for Sartre, for de Beauvoir, for José Ortega y Gasset, for all these thinkers that we could call existential thinkers post-World War I, who lived through World War II or lived through like the Spanish Civil War, or lived through these moments of fascist creep and totalitarian and authoritarian horror, existential philosophy was a response to that dehumanization that had infected and filtered into all segments of society. Reason and existence are the two notions that Jaspers picks up for these lectures. The Dutch will have their own problems with Nazis, within a couple of years. Reason and existence, but he comes there to kind of point out to them that the specter haunting Europe now, not the Marxist specter, but the specter haunting Europe now is simply this dehumanization. Not the rational, which is reason. Not the non-rational, which is existence. Existence is non-rational in the sense that it, what I've been saying to you, in the sense for Kierkegaard and for Jaspers, existence is the fully free expression of your singularity, which does not reduce down to subject-object rational discussion. Okay? So that's why existence is the non-rational. So you have the rational and the non-rational. But what is the great danger? Why do we need to talk about, what it is, the non-rational, which is your freedom, and the rational, which is what connects together everything in some kind of an order? Why is this what he's talking about in his lectures? Because he's trying to prepare people to get ready to combat in their minds and in their lives the anti-rational. Stalinist totalitarianism, Nazi totalitarianism, fascist totalitarianism, capitalist totalitarianism. Okay? The anti-rational is the enemy of freedom. Okay? This is why I really think that maybe it would be good. I told y'all you could find it online. I think that I'm going to put the Ur-Fascist piece by Umberto Eco up on our thing. You don't have to read it for the class, but I think it'd be good for me to make it available to y'all because it kind of like demonstrates the anti-rationalist commitments that people slip into. Okay. All right, so now I've gone for almost 25 minutes, about 20 minutes, just sort of setting you up in a way. I didn't set you up this way with Sartre and Dostoevsky. I'm leaving you to discover that for yourself. I am setting you up this way with Jaspers because A, I'm a Jaspersian. I'm in the line of lineage. I'm in a lineage from Jaspers through Owsley. But also because Jaspers, who has a beautiful voice for helping us discover how to combat anti-reason when we see it, is not a philosopher who gets reading. You're actually getting an existential, even with the fact that, you know, Kaufman has him in that book, Jaspers does not get a lot of reading or use nowadays, because academic philosophy became something that concerned itself with who are the thinkers who we can't understand because I can make a career out of that. Kant can be understood if you think about the things that you're taught with Kant. You're not giving Kant stuff on the power of judgment and his general stuff on the critique of practical reason. It's very rare. You're given little selections, but not the really readable stuff that he did. You're given the stuff that he did that's very difficult to understand most of the time, because you need somebody to explain it to you. Yeah, I'm giving motives to people. It makes the professor necessary. I am giving you Jaspers not because you need me to explain Jaspers, as much as he kind of roams around a little bit sometimes, but because Jaspers is understandable. And not only is he understandable, he's useful in preparing you against the ongoing totalitarian creep in our lives. Right? Existential philosophy is having a reawakening now because we live in a society, this globalized society, which has got all kinds of different variations on authoritarian and totalitarian structure. Right? And people are beginning to react to it by adopting more totalitarian responses. Right? So there's more, if you actually would ask me this, even with the stuff that I saw as a little boy in Texas that were about, racist things that I saw and homophobic things that I saw, if you would have told me that in 2017 there would be as much racism, homophobia, and God knows what else that you see just commonly thrown around as we do now, I would have said, no, things, you're crazy. This is what we told you in 1987. Right? So we're kind of living through this period. So now we look at this lecture. Let's look at this lecture. Go, turn in the hymnal to page 48 if you have it with you. Oh, yeah, I still wanted to point out, I've been putting the lecture portions and a couple of the whiteboards up on that page that I set up at my blog. So there at the bottom, with respect to our epoch and the thought of Kierkegaard and Nietzsche, if we pose the question, what now? Then Kierkegaard points in the direction of an absurd Christianity before which the world sinks away. And Nietzsche points to the distance, to the indeterminate, which does not appear to be a substance out of which we can live. Nobody has accepted their answers. They are not ours. It is for us to see what will become of us through ourselves as we look upon them. This is, however, in no way to sketch out or establish anything in advance. What is he talking about right now? Why Kierkegaard and Nietzsche offer no answer? Yeah.
Because, they want us to find our own answers. They don't want us to just follow in their footsteps, whatever they think.
Yeah. Good. Yes?
Wouldn't that go back to the whole, autonomy thing? If you're solely autonomous, then you can't rely on other people to give you the answers.
Right. You need other people in the sense we're always thrown into a community in order to do our I, not I discourse, right? But we can't just fall on these people and say, I'm going to be like Nietzsche, gonna be like Kierkegaard. I'm gonna use him as my model. Yeah, Caleb?
I mean, I think they don't provide answers, but they give us the tools. You know, Nietzsche gives us the will to power,
right.
Kierkegaard gives us the leap of faith.
Right.
And they say, you know, here are the tools that you can use in order to become your own existence, but
good. And again, with Jaspers, what he always does, it's very rare that he gives you an answer to anything. He sketches things out and kind of points in a direction and then says, get to moving. Right? Thus we would err if we thought we could deduce what must now happen from a world historical survey of the development of the human spirit. Now this is in direct contradiction of Nazis and communists. You see this? You see why? This is direct contradiction of Nazis and communists. Do you who can tell me, Nick, do you know why? You've nodded your head. You're just like, yeah, I want it to be. Is that what you, or do you know why?
I'm assuming it's because they tell us what our end point is.
Yeah, they tell you exactly what's going to happen.
Yeah.
Right? The Nazis are, you want to talk about resentment? Let's talk about the Nazis. They turn their asses toward, their ass faces towards the beginnings of history. Right? And they recover the entirety of history in a phony, syncretic mythology that tells you that it is the destiny of the Aryan to conquer all other races, right? And then the Marxists, I like Marx, okay? But let's think about 1936 totalitarian Stalinist Marxism. They turn their way to the future and they say that everything is going to fall under the material weight of a predetermined historical revolution. Okay? I don't want to fall backwards by reading that. Thus, we would err if we thought we could deduce what must now happen from a world historical survey of the development of the human spirit. We do not stand outside like a god who can survey the whole at a glance. This is also the problem of how Hegel is made use of. Right? For us, the present cannot be replaced by some supposed world history out of which our situation and problems would emerge. There's a little more of that Nazis, you know, he's being snarky with the Nazis. Right. And this lecture has no intention of surveying the whole, but rather of making the present situation perceptible by reflecting upon the past. The present situation. What is the problem of resentment? You cannot be in the present. Right? You get lost in the vengeance and envy and hatred of the past or the imagination of a future where you conquer and show everybody they should have paid attention to. You can't be in the present situation. We're going to look at the present situation. That's what I want y'all to be doing. I want you reading Sam Mickey's book, Coexistentialism, to be thinking about this rise of existential thinking in this period so that you will make use of it in your present situation. Okay? And I want your midterm to be an existential examination of your own situation, your own self. Who am I? What am I doing? Where do I find myself? What's going on? No one will ever see it besides me. I will make a copy of it. I'll give it back to you. Nobody knows where man and his thinking are going. Since existence, man, and the world are not an end, a completed philosophy is as little possible as an anticipation of the whole. You've got to remember that neo-Kantianism, Hegelianism, Marxism, Freudianism, Nazism, fascism, phalangism. May I go on? I can come up with more, probably.
Let's do it.
Capitalism. We said the C word in public. Capitalism. Oh, hold on, I can do it. Hooverism. Well, I can't come up with more, but I'm not going to go. I mean, I could if I really stopped and think about it. But there's all the big hitters. Oh, Stalinism, Trotskyism. Stalinism, Trotskyism, Leninism, Maoism. Yeah, okay, that's enough. Anyways. Right? They all know where humanity is going. Well, yeah, I could also point here too towards the way some people in Christianity, Islam, Judaism think about what's going on too. Nobody knows where man and his thinking are going, since existence, humanity, and our world are not an end. A completed philosophy is as little possible as an anticipation of the whole. We have plans with finite ends, but something else always comes out which no one willed. You're getting shades of his method here, because he wants people to recognize that each of us in our situation, right, is delimited by certain conditions. That among these conditions are death, guilt, struggle, suffering, and chance. For Jaspers, these are the boundary situations, the limit situations that make up the human condition. Now, you look at all of that, Zuri, you'll remember this spiel. You look at all that and you think, oh, this is so negative. It's all so negative because, you know, you've been through 60 years of American. Let's think positive about stuff. Let's think joy, joy. Where's the joy? Where's the laughter? There is no life without death. There's no freedom without guilt or forgiveness without guilt. There's no ease without struggle. There's no joy without suffering or pleasure without suffering. And there's no purpose without chance. But these are the limits of any of those things. Can you not see that? That we live because we die? That we experience forgiveness because we're guilty, that we experience facility because there's struggle, that we experience pleasure because there's suffering, that we experience purpose because we know accidents are going to get in the way. Purpose. That we are willing to put ourselves forward, right? Not that it's all worked out ahead of time, but that we're willing to purposefully decide to choose for ourselves to explore these limits and push them. Okay? We humans have plans with finite ends, but something else always comes out which no one will. In the same way, philosophizing is an act which works upon the inwardness of humankind, but whose final meaning we cannot know. Philosophizing is the willingness to be uncertain and the will to ask questions. We cannot know what will come out of our philosophizing. Okay? There are no thousand-year Reichs that come out of a philosopher. Thus, the contemporary problem is not to be deduced from some a priori whole. Does this all sound familiar? Is not to be produced from some a priori whole. Rather, it is to be brought to consciousness out of a basis which is now experienced and out of a content still unclearly willed. Philosophy as thought is always a consciousness of being which is complete for this moment, but which knows it has no final permanence in its form of expression. Okay? This is why philosophy is not that. Yeah, that's going to continue to be added to, but the basics of it is a final expression. Philosophy is not twice two is four. The additive principle is a final expression. Philosophizing will always take us back for these existential thinkers. They're going to end up being people who want to say, like Quine, that philosophy of science is philosophy enough. I don't want to get into all this existential stuff. Philosophy of thought is always a consciousness of being which is complete for this moment, but which knows it has no final permanence in its form of expression. And so we're here with reason and existence. With reason and existence. With the non-rational. And the inter-existential. Reason is a mode of being that binds together all of the other modes of being that we are. Okay? And I'm just giving y'all a little taste of what we're going to do next week. Reason is a mode of being that binds together all of the other modes of being that we are and connects us in a way to the world in its actuality. And to whatever might be beyond our normal understanding and its possibility. So instead of some supposed total view of the actual and cultural situation, rather we philosophize in consciousness of a situation which again leads to the final limits and bases of the human reality. There's these final limits, these ultimate situations. Ultimate situations. Okay. Today, no one can completely and clearly develop the intellectual problems that grow out of such a situation. I am not saying that we now need to take all this stuff up and now we've got a way, we've got the tools and the answers to deal with fascist creep and totalitarian titleness. That we now have all the tools we need, everything is there for us to solve the climate problem and to solve the environmental crisis. It's to do what Sam does in his book Coexistentialism, is to take these things up and then to make use of them in our situation and add to them and discover ways that they've not been used before. We live, so to speak, in a seething cauldron of possibilities, continually threatened by confusion, but always ready, in spite of everything, to rise up again. In philosophizing, we must always be ready, out of the present questioning, to elicit those ideas which bring forth what is real to us, our humanity, our humanization. So this is where we're at with these lectures over the course of the next few weeks as we read them at the end of every week. Okay? And the lectures, this particular lecture sets up what we're doing next week with Kierkegaard and Nietzsche, obviously. Okay? But it should also be making you ask yourself, why in the hell am I in a philosophy class? What did I think philosophy was for in the first place? How does this differ with what I've been doing in other philosophy classes? Why does it sound like less than that? Or why does it sound like more than that? Or why does it sound totally other than that? That's what we should be doing today, is thinking about that. All right? This particular lecture was long on comparisons of Nietzsche and Kierkegaard. Okay. Jaspers is actually the reason why Kierkegaard was even remembered. He repopularized Kierkegaard. Right? And he was one of the few people in the 30s who was writing and talking about Nietzsche, who tried to provide some sort of way of thinking about Nietzsche that salvaged him from the fascists. So, you know, it was important to him as well to kind of put forward this idea of these thinkers and this notion of exception. So what does it mean? So, you know, one of the things y'all might discuss today is what does it mean to be an exception? And, are you getting everything? Do you think that you understood why he was saying they were exceptions? These are things that y'all should talk about today, I think, with each other. And what does it mean to be an exception in the really fundamental sense of exceptional? Can you talk about the exception? Or is it so exceptional it can't even be discussed? Right? You can just be recognized. That makes sense. All right, I'll take one question before I let y'all break up. Listen to me being authoritarian. Who's going to get their hand up first and have a question, comment? Anybody? If I overwhelmed you yet again? I always have to be careful because I know that if I'd been born in a different time, in a different way, and not exposed to Jaspers, I could just easily ended up being a Pentecostal preacher or a fascist, whichever. Not that that Pentecostal preacher is a fascist.
Pretty damn close.
Well, I've come from a long line of Pentecostal preachers. So.
Yeah.
When it says philosophy as thought, what does it mean by philosophy as thought?
Philosophy as thought really kind of goes to the heart of the idea that I think Sartre would agree with this to a certain extent too, and definitely Heidegger would, that real thinking is philosophical. So real thoughts that bring out and throw light on things is always philosophical. And so chemists who have PhDs, when they allow themselves to rise back to the level to rise to the level of philosophizing. I mean, they have a PhD. They're doctors of philosophy in chemistry, right? I mean, a good portion of them, that's just a bureaucratic thing so that they can teach in a university. But some of them, they really philosophize new thinking, right? So that's what it is. So thinking actually comes out of philosophizing, but very quickly can get sidetracked into the certainties of science or the certainties of religion or even the certainties of aesthetics. Okay, all right, let's break up into our groups. Everybody take a couple of minutes to breathe and say, okay. McKenzie, was that helpful?
Yes.
Thanks. All right, so everybody get up. And so we'll come back with our guiding questions at 15 after 1, okay? But y'all take a couple of minutes to refresh your minds and then find groups of find each other in groups.
Oh, you know. Okay.